What would it mean to use love as a guiding principle in cooking and eating? Would that change how you shop for food? Would it change how you cook at home or the experience of eating out?
I had this pretty incredible meal when I was 19 years old at Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley. It was by far the most expensive restaurant I'd ever been to, so we saved $220 and we had this really magical meal there. It was a pretty classic French menu. Frisée salad au lardon, which has a poached egg and a mustardy vinaigrette and little pieces of crispy pancetta, halibut in broth, guinea hen with little wild mushrooms and green beans. The dessert was chocolate souffle. I had never had chocolate souffle before, or any souffle. When the woman brought the chocolate souffle, she said, "Would you like me to show you how to eat it?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, you take your spoon and you poke a hole in the middle. Then you pour this sauce in." It was like a raspberry sauce. So I did that and I took a bite. And she said, "How is it?" And I said, "Oh, it's really good, but you know what would make it even better? I would love a glass of cold milk." In fancy food, milk is only for babies. And I just had no idea how rude it was and like presumptuous to tell somebody in a restaurant how to make their food even better. So she brought me a glass of milk and she also brought two glasses of dessert wine to teach us the refined accompaniment. It was really super sweet and just what I consider to be the beginning of my culinary education.
Samin Nosrat fell in love with a restaurant, Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Now, a lot of people have fallen in love with Chez Panisse. It's the legendary restaurant that launched the farm-to-table movement in America. And over time, Samin developed her own philosophy of cooking, based on a few universal principles, salt, fat, acid, and heat, which is the title of her cookbook, which won this year's James Beard Award. Now, Halima Shah has been thinking about our question this hour. What is real food, authentic food? And how does Samin compare what she learned at Chez Panisse to what she learned growing up as an Iranian-American kid in San Diego?
Oh, man, my mom is an extraordinary cook. And, you know, in our family, the highest compliment anything could get, any dish or food or ingredient, was that it tasted like Iran. And my mom was just always in search of the ingredients that tasted like Iran. So I always joke that my brothers and I spent 40% of our childhood in the backseat of the Volvo station wagon driving around Southern California because my mom would drive. You know, on the weekends, we would go all the way to Irvine, like 100 miles away, to this bakery to get fresh Persian bread. She would drive across town to just get like just the right cilantro or the lamb that tasted the lambiest or the feta cheese that was the saltiest and tangiest. And so food, I think, was really the way that our family came together.
So what foods do you remember most? Was there a family favorite?
The sort of centerpiece of most Iranian dinners is rice with a crispy crust called tadig. My mom is just such an expert at making the most beautiful tadigs. Big, beautiful pots of rice with this crispy crust that we were all fighting over. Very fragrant stews. One of the most beautiful parts of Persian cooking philosophy is that for every element, there should be a contrasting element on the plate. Always like something hot and something cold. There's always like a cold spoonful of yogurt. There's something fluffy and soft, and then there's something crunchy. There's something sour and there's something sweet. So this was just sort of built into the way that my mom built meals and put them together. And I was so surrounded by it that it became a way that I understand eating and cooking as well.
I have to say, I really relate to the driving long distances to pick up the best Persian ingredient. I'm from Chicago, and it's 2.5 hours from where I live now. I think every time I visit, I bring back a samosa haul because that's where the best Pakistani food I can find in the Midwest is. Or like I go to a halal meat store and bring back like $50 worth of meat, and the guy at the register is like, "What are you going to do with all this chicken?" You do have a special connection to home cooking, and your book, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, feels like an anti-cookbook because it's not focused on recipes. Why did you choose to break down cooking into those four elements instead?
At the beginning of my cooking career, the chefs who were teaching me how to cook gave me a stack of cookbooks to go read. So that was what I understood cooking to be, was to go home, open a book, follow the instructions, measure the things, set the timer, and ideally make the thing that comes out of the oven or off the stove tasting right. And it never did. And that wasn't reflected at all in what I saw at work, which was constant tasting, constant tinkering, constant adjusting, that no 2 days we ever made things in the same way. Every single day we were just using taste and our senses to guide us. And I remember I had sort of a light bulb moment early in my cooking career when I understood that these four elements were guiding us in the kitchen, like points on a compass.
What do each of those do? What does salt, fat, acid, and heat do?
Salt. If there's one thing that everybody needs to learn how to use in the kitchen, it's salt. Salt enhances flavor. If you get the salt right, not just how much, but when and how, in what form to add it, you can just get your food really, really, really close to being perfect. Fat also affects flavor, especially choosing which fat we cook in will set a dish on a trajectory culturally. If you start with ghee, your food will taste like it comes from India or Pakistan because that's the fat they use there. And fat also determines texture, creaminess and crispiness and flakiness. So learning how to use fat and which fat to use creates exciting textures and flavors in our food. Acid, whereas salt enhances flavor, acid balances it. Acid provides contrast. And sometimes in just the tiniest form, so that you don't even taste the sour thing, it's just creating a little bit of a secret second layer in the taste. Lemon juice and vinegar, the tang of cheese or yogurt. Chocolate is acidic, and coffee and tea, and even honey and even sugar. And of course, heat. Low heat over a long period of time or high heat over a shorter period of time. And that really is what determines the texture of foods. A lot of tender foods require high heat applied very quickly to preserve their tenderness. And a lot of dry, tough foods require water and low, gentle heat to become something tender and delicious and something that falls apart. And over time, over my cooking career, as I sat with these four elements and traveled and just learned more about cooking from different cultures, I saw that these elements are universal. Of course, different cuisines, you know, maybe have different tastes. Like Thai food has a lot of sweet and spicy and sour things. And Japanese food has a lot of umami and salt and sourness also and sweetness. But salt and fat and acid are basically just human things that as humans we've evolved to want in our food.
Well, you write that you were like a scholar in search of primary sources when you were trying to learn how to make various dishes authentically. Tell me about the people and places that taught you about food.
Well, probably the most formative place that I visited and the people who really taught me the most were, as a young cook, I moved to Italy and I lived there for 2 years. And there are a lot of things that I found really almost amusing as an outsider. One of them is the incredible regionality of Italian cooking. All the way across the world, had read books and studied and loved to eat, for example, fried squash blossoms stuffed with cheese. And one day I came and I tried to make those for my friends in Florence and Tuscany, and they were all shocked. They were like, "You have invented the best thing. We've never heard of this. We've never seen such a thing." And I just was like, "You know, this is from Rome, which is 150 miles away. Like, I didn't invent anything." But there's sort of this beauty that comes from the incredible investment that Italians have to their own traditional foods and to their place and to their people and their families and the way that their mom did it. And in some ways, their grandmas became my grandmas.
Well, that makes me think of this other question that's coming up right now in this time where our food is really intersecting with our politics. And that's the question of authenticity. Mm-hmm. For you, What does it mean to be able to cook something authentically?
Oh, man, that word I feel like is so loaded right now in this moment. And I think authenticity is sort of overrated in some ways.
Why?
Why is it overrated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is something I haven't spent a ton of time articulating, but let me give you an example. So there's a great food writer and podcaster named Soleil Ho, and she wrote this piece that has just like sort of been reverberating in my head for probably the past year about assimilation food. You know, the food that immigrants cook in America with the ingredients that are available to them. And all of these weird, like, mashup dishes. And I think of the cooking that I do that I call Iranian and I feed to my friends in Berkeley. And I know that if my mother or grandmother saw that, they would be like, this isn't Iranian food. So, you know, does that mean that it's not authentic? Does the stuff that my mom had to cook for us in San Diego using Californian ingredients, is that not authentic? To me, that was, you know, the most delicious and authentic stuff. And a lot of times when I went back to Iran and ate the stuff there, I was like, my mom's is better, you know? So I just don't know what authentic is and what the search for authenticity exactly, like what the value there is.
And I'm also really interested how your recipes are influenced by both your mom's home cooking and your training as a chef. One of the recipes you talk about in the book is for a Persian frittata. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. So that is something called kuku sabzi. So kuku is just sort of the Persian word for like frittata. And sabzi means greens. And my mom makes the best kuku sabzi. She chops mountains of herbs and greens and then uses the bare minimum of eggs to bind it together. So it's almost like you're eating this greens cake. And I had a lot of shame at first about sharing my mom's cooking in a professional kitchen because I thought it wouldn't be respected or valued in any way. And then at some point I started just making kuku sabzi and people started going wild for it because it was unlike anything that they'd ever seen. And it's so delicious and so nutritious. And my mom is really good at creating a really dark brown crust. So there's this sort of amazing contrast between the beautiful, almost burnt crust of herbs and then the inside tender eggs and much more fresh, vibrant greens. It's really an extraordinary thing.
That sounds totally delicious, and I'm cooking it next week. That was Samin Nosrat talking with Halima Shah. Samin's cookbook is called Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat.